You ever lost something? You ever been looking for something and you're scouring the house looking everywhere for it and you just can't find it and you thought you knew exactly where you placed it and you thought you're going to go back to it and pick it up and there it is and you've got it. You know, I find that the older I get, the more common that is an occurrence for me. And recently, it's something that happened to me, and it was just a very frustrating moment on many fronts. But I was trying to do something around the house, and I was looking for my power screwdriver, and I just needed it. I'd done something the day before. I thought I had left it in the kitchen, and so when I was ready to do this thing, I went up. I went right to the kitchen where I thought I'd left it. Not there. And I started scouring the house up and down, basement, second floor, garage, the car, anywhere I thought I could have left this thing. And everywhere I looked, no avail. I'm walking through the house, past the kitchen, up the stairs. I mean, every room was touched at least 3 times, and I probably walked through the kitchen about 20 times. And what I found is when I couldn't place where it was, then it was no longer a where problem, it became a who problem. Okay, now you guys, you've been there, right? And let's go ahead and put this on the screen because you'll see the cast of characters at my house that then it becomes a question of who did it, right? Okay, so some of you have, you know, I have 800 children at home, so I look at this cast of characters and don't let the sweet faces fool you either, okay? They will. One of them got a pass because she's overseas about 4,000 miles away, so she gets a pass. Hannah's out. She's in London, so she couldn't have done it. But let's look at these rest of, you know, characters here. Look, the one on the end there, Jasmine, doesn't that little one look sweet? But man, can she cause some trouble. The next one next to Jasmine, I love her dearly. We'll be married 22 years this year, but that woman can touch my stuff more than anybody else I know when I'm looking for it. I couldn't say this in the first service because she was here, so I get to be a little more vocal about it now. And then you can just count any of the others, you know. And so I'm looking for it. I've looked everywhere. And then I start accusing people. And of course, I'm very honest with you guys. My go-to emotion is not like, you know, crying or weeping or compassion. It's wrath. And so as I'm looking for it, then I'm like, who's going to suffer the wrath of Brent? I'm about to bring it down because somebody has moved my screwdriver and I can't find it anywhere. And then what makes this story even more frustrating is as I walk back into the kitchen, not far off from where I thought I had placed it, guess what I found? It's happened to you too. Fantastic. It did. It was right there. And then it leads me to this question of how did this happen? How is it possible that I have walked past this thing at least 20 times and I missed it every time? And it's not like it's a blend into the background kind of thing. It's a Black and Decker. It's orange and black. It kind of stands out. You would think it would jump out at me. Growing up, my dad had an expression that he loved to say all the time. If it'd been a snake, it'd have bit you. Well, you know what? I wish it would have been, then I'd have not wasted all that time looking for it, right? You know, how is it that sometimes when we're looking for something that can be right in front of our face, we can miss it? Has it ever happened to you? Maybe you've been with a friend and you're out and your friend sees something. This is a frustrating moment. And they say, oh, look over here. Do you see it? And you're like, no. No, it's right there. See it? No, it's right in front of me. I get it's right in front of me. I still can't see it. You know, don't you feel that way? Of course, if it's a friend, depending on the level of friendship, you may or may not be able to say that. It gets frustrating, doesn't it? Now, you may think, why is he going to this length in this introduction? Because as we wrap up our series today on spiritual warfare, this comes into play very heavily in how people around us see something or don't see something that we see, but it's right in front of their faces. You know, we've spent 7 weeks now. Today is week 8, and we never anticipated this series would go this long. It's just kind of where it's taken us. But over the last 7 weeks, we've spent every Sunday talking about how the struggle is real. That even though many in our culture would discount this and say, oh, because you can't see it, it can't be real. We said, no, unseen does not mean unreal. And that there is a very real battle taking place in the spiritual realm that we better be paying attention to. We better be aware of, because if we're not, we will be defeated by what we can't see. What we can't see can hurt us. And we want to make sure that we're paying attention. And so we've talked about how the struggle is real and Satan is a real enemy and the battlefield is of the mind and how we have to put on the armor and how prayer plays into this. And we've taken weeks talking about this. And today, the Sunday before Easter, what I really felt was appropriate was to talk about how real this spiritual struggle is, especially when it comes to the battle for humanity, or what I wanted to call it was the battle for lost souls. Because just like with my screwdriver, for so many people out in the world who don't believe, the gospel can be right in front of their faces, and yet amazingly, they still miss it. Amazingly, as clear as it may be to us, they still don't see and they still don't understand. Paul talks about this in the book of 2 Corinthians. What's amazing is most everything we've done over 7 weeks has been Paul's writing, so it's very clear that he had a firsthand experience with this spiritual warfare on many fronts, in the church, in his own life personally, and now he talks about how the spiritual battle affects those who don't believe or don't follow Jesus. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 is where we're going to be. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Let me read what Paul wrote to you. Paul says, "Therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. Rather, we have renounced secret and shameful ways. We do not use deception, nor do we distort the word of God. On the contrary, by setting forth the plain truth plainly, we commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel that displays the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ." As Paul writes, what he does for me in this moment is answers one of the greatest questions that I think I always ask. And I think it's a legitimate question for anybody of faith to ask. It's this question here. If we really believe that following Jesus is so great, then why isn't everyone following Jesus? You ever asked that before? Think about Jesus for just a moment. If we really believe who he says he is and he does what he says he does, if we believe that he's as loving as he says he is and we've experienced that love, if we believe that he can bring peace into the chaos of our lives, if we believe that he redeems us and reconciles us to himself, if we believe that he offered his life for us and not just on the cross he died, but he rose again so that we too can experience that same level of life in our own experience, in our own lives, if we really believe that Jesus Christ came and offered salvation for all, that to give our lives meaning and purpose, then why in the world isn't everybody following Jesus? Because is there anything greater than knowing and living for Jesus and following him? I don't think so. But it's easy for us to look around into the world, and it's clear that not everybody is following Jesus. Now, there's probably some reasons that we can look at to say, oh, well, why are they not believing? Well, you know, and we're going to talk about maybe some causes of blindness. But, you know, just on the surface, maybe people go, I can't buy into that. I'm too reasonable. I'm too intellectual. I'm too whatever. And they can't see that. Or maybe they look at Christianity and they say, oh, because the church is full of hypocrites. Or maybe this church thing, they're known more for what they stand against than what they're for. That we don't model for them Christianity in a way that's very appealing or attractive. Maybe that's what they see. Maybe they look and they say, well, I watch people that claim to follow Jesus and there's really no difference in their lives between how they live and how I live. I mean, they have the same ethic that I do. They, divorce at the same rate that we do. They cheat on their taxes just like we do, the same sexual ethic as we have. So why would I waste a Sunday morning getting up and going to church when it really doesn't seem to make that big of a difference? You know, when somebody attacks faith, when somebody attacks Christianity, it's easy for us to get defensive. That's my position. I'm a very competitive person. It seems to be lessening some the older I get, a little bit. But when somebody attacks something that I care about or love, my first inclination is not to retreat. You know, you hear a lot of times in conflict, there's two basic positions, fight or flight. Flight is never a response of mine. Mine is dig in, lean forward, and come with guns blazing. Amy's laughing because she's on staff here. She sees this in me as a staff person here. I dig in, I fight. And so when I hear some of these things that people might say, it makes me angry. It makes me say, no, that's not the faith of Jesus. That's not how it's supposed to be. But I think if we're honest, I think we have to admit that sometimes when people outside of faith look at us, they can have some valid points. And these are things that we should address. We should address the hypocrisy that sometimes churches have. We should address, are our lives really transformed and lived in a manner that is pleasing to Jesus? Do we look like Jesus in how we live as opposed to looking religious? And so I think there are some things that we could evaluate, but that's really not the main thing. No matter what somebody says, no matter how they may look at people of faith, and no matter what excuse or what reasoning they may give, we don't have to get defensive. We don't have to fight because it reveals to us what Paul has said here. We need to take a step back and look that Paul is telling us that the root cause of the reason why people aren't following Jesus isn't really their reasoning. It really isn't the things that they've told you, because there's something greater in play, because at the root cause of this blindness is the God of this age, as Paul said it, the God of this age. Who is that? That's a terminology that's used for Satan. Satan is described as the god of this age. And what Paul is saying to us today is that Satan has blinded those who do not yet follow Jesus. It's like the screwdriver in the kitchen that was just a few feet off from where I left it. I walked by it 20 times and I missed it every time. Satan does that. He puts up spiritual blinders in front of the eyes that prevents people from being able to see the truth of the gospel. And when we want to fight and we want to defend ourselves, it really plays into the wrong narrative. It really addresses the wrong problem, because as people who follow Jesus, we don't have to defend necessarily what we do. What we have to do first and foremost is attack the problem at its root, which is the blindness of the enemy that wants to keep the kingdom of God from progressing in this world. As we've said each and every week, the spiritual struggle is not necessarily against Brent. It's not necessarily even against you. It's against the work of God in this world. God's kingdom is moving forward, and God's kingdom grows and expands by more and more people seeing and understanding the gospel and coming in to the kingdom. And that is target number one for the enemy. And Satan wants to do whatever he can to blind people. To call Satan the God of this age can be kind of confusing, because we think of God and we think big and almighty and all-powerful. And it's not. Just because Paul may describe Satan this way, it doesn't mean that he has ultimate authority. God is still sovereign. God is still all-powerful. Satan is not. But it does mean that he is going to wreak havoc in a lot of ways, and one of the ways is by preventing people from believing in Jesus. He prevents them from seeing the light. He keeps them in darkness. And no matter how many times they walk by it, no matter how many times you may talk about faith, no matter how many times they may see it lived out in front of them, they can still miss it because of the spiritual battle taking place. Even what they see right in front of their face, their blindness prevents them from being able to see it or comprehend it. So when we hear people look for reasons to discount Christianity or discount Christ, we need to stop being so critical. If you follow Christ, we need to stop being so critical of the individual, and we need to realize that just because they're blind doesn't mean they're stupid, and it doesn't mean that this person is the enemy. We've said this from the beginning as well. Our battle is not against flesh and blood. That's exactly right. The person standing in front of you is not your enemy. They are, in a lot of ways, a victim to the God of this age. And the question we have to ask is, what are we doing to help that individual see? And we've spent 7 weeks talking about how we can do this in the armor and prayer. But even though they may not see right now, we need to understand Satan's not going to go down without a fight, but it doesn't mean he's always going to win. We see the greatest example of this in the Apostle Paul himself. There's no greater example. The Apostle Paul was a religious guy. He was a zealot. He was had such fervor about his faith and his Judaism and his belief in God that when Christianity comes on the scene, when these new people come and they start preaching this man named Jesus, this Nazarene who was died and crucified on a cross, but he rose again, Paul didn't look at that and go, yeah, I believe that initially. No, what did he do? He said, I've got to snuff this problem out. I've got to take care of this. And he was so zealous about this that he went around from church to church to drag people out, to take people from their homes. And when they confessed Jesus as Lord, he would have them arrested and persecuted and thrown in jail. That was his motivation. It's very clear to see that in that time of his life, Paul was blind. But on the road to Damascus, that one day, when that bright light shone on him, the darkness was dispelled. It was removed. It was taken away. And for the first time in his life, Paul was able to see. That's the struggle. That's the battle that we're talking about. And even though Satan's going to fight us, it is a battle that we can win. This is a battle that we can win. We need to try to see what we can do to help remove the blindness. And maybe you're here today, and I realize it can be kind of offensive to say, are you blind? But I think we're all blind to some things in some ways. My question is, are we blind to the gospel of Jesus? What is it that could be blinding us? I kind of reduced this down to four main categories. This isn't an exhaustive list, and to be honest, each of these could be a sermon unto themselves, but I'm not going to do that to you this morning. I'm going to keep it brief, well, as brief as I can keep it. I think there are four things that that blind people today. The first one is this, our intelligence. There's this wild, crazy belief that says if you are a person of faith, you must check your brain at the door. That you can't be a reasonable individual, you can't be a reasoned and logical-minded person and still have faith because those two are mutually exclusive. We see this played out maybe in people who are atheists, people who are agnostic. These are the ones that just look and they say, if I can't see it, if I can't experience it, and then it can't be true. And they automatically discount it. It's our intelligence. They say, I can't make that leap of faith. So what they do, on the other hand, is they say, well, then if faith isn't the answer and it can't be real, everything must be defined by the mind. Everything must be controlled by secular reasoning. Our reasoning will be in control. Our reasoning will dictate what is true. But the problem with that is when we just begin to question that premise itself. Can secular reasoning really hold up to that level of explaining everything? You just have to live life one day to say, I don't think so. There's a philosopher whose name is Jürgen Habermas, and he once called for and said that in public debate, there can only be secular reasoning. We can't bring faith or religion or any of this stuff into public debate. But years later, he changed his tune. And he says, and he knows now that secular reasoning cannot account for the substance of humanity. He began to look at things like freedom and justice, love and beauty. And he said, scientific knowledge has little to do with these things that are part and central to being human. Pastor Tim Keller says this, is that if your intellect gets in your way of faith, and you doubt faith, why do you not doubt your reasoning as well? Apply the same level of doubt to what you say is your standard to see if it actually can hold up to the same level of scrutiny. And oftentimes when you doubt your doubts, you see that it can't stand up. Our intelligence can be something that blinds us. And let me just say that I don't think at all that reasoning and faith are mutually exclusive. I think you can be very much a thinking person and very much an individual with a rational mind and still believe in God, because I see that many, many do. Secondly, I think the second thing that can blind us is our inclusiveness. Our desire to be so inclusive will blind us to the message of the gospel. What do I mean? We see this so often in our culture today, but it's not just our culture today. You guys know I don't rail on our culture necessarily, but for 2,000 years, it's been the desire of humanity to say, no, can't we all just get along? No, there are multiple paths to God. No, you believe what you want, and I'll believe what I want, and it'll all work out in the end. It's pluralism. It says, don't worry about it, that we're all on this mountain moving up different paths to God, and eventually we'll all get there, because it doesn't matter what you believe, because God's at the top and we make it all eventually. But let me ask you, if that's what we believe, how can mutually exclusive beliefs all be valid? How can, if I believe Jesus is the only way, how can that be as valid as a belief that says he's not the only way? It doesn't seem to make rational sense to me. And for those who sit and say, yeah, but we're all on this mountain and God's at the top, how do you know that? Isn't there a level of arrogance that comes from someone that says, I can see something that no one else can see? I have a vantage point of a mountain that you can't see because you're so small-minded you're on the mountain? I don't think that's rational. I don't think that makes sense. I think we have to move back and say, okay, can these mutually exclusive beliefs all be valid? And I don't think they can be. And I don't want to make light of this, because this is a big one for many people. Christianity, yes, it does make exclusive claims. Yes, it does say that Jesus is the only way. But a desire for all beliefs to be equal doesn't necessarily make that happen, make it so. After all, what are you basing that belief on? A hope, a desire, or there's something greater that you're building there? And I would challenge those that think Christianity is so exclusive to really go back from a historical perspective and look and see just how inclusive Christianity actually is. In his book, The Reason for God, which if you've never read it, I highly recommend it, Tim Keller wrote this. He says that in the Greco-Roman world, religious views were considered to be very open and appeared on the surface to be very tolerant. But in reality, it was a quite brutal culture. In fact, they called Christians atheists because they believed in only one God instead of the multiple deities in their culture. And the disparity between people of this religious system was huge. There were very much the haves and the have-nots, the ins and the outs. In this culture where they said, oh no, we'll just all believe everything and we'll all be the same. It didn't work that way. Humanity doesn't work that way. And there was huge disparity there. But in contrast, when you look at Christianity, the faith that Jesus talked about, the one that he modeled, did something that no other faith had ever done before. Because at the cross, the playing field was leveled. What do I mean? The call of Jesus Christ to individuals was not to the ins or the outs, to the religious or the non-religious. When Jesus said, come follow me, he said that to men and to women. Shocking and scandalous at that day. He said it to the rich and to the poor. He said it to the white and the black. He said it to everyone. He said, my offer of salvation is not exclusive to any one group. There is no haves and haves not. My invitation to you is for everyone. In fact, Christianity teaches this sacrificial service, generosity, and peacemaking. And at the very heart of our belief is a man who told us and showed how to die for your enemies, to love them, to pray for their forgiveness. And it's that desire for inclusion that binds us together. The third thing here I think that blinds us is our individuality. It's our individuality, it's who we are. There can be a lot of factors under this individuality category. I think sometimes it's the way we're brought up. You ever wonder if the only reason you're a Christian is because you were raised in a Christian home? Some people are on the opposite side. They're blind, not because of their own doing, but because of the home they were raised in. Sometimes in this individuality thing, it can be our own, where we were born, but the things that have happened to us, past pains and hurts and hang-ups that prevent us from seeing the gospel, maybe the bitterness and things that happened to us, maybe by not our own fault, maybe it was by our own fault, but it keeps us, our individuality, who we are, keeps us from being able to see the truth. And our bitterness and unforgiveness blinds us to the forgiveness and peace that Jesus offers. And the last area is this. You're going to appreciate this. They're all four I's, and I worked hard to make sure that it was alliterative. Last one is our industriousness. What do I mean by that? We like to work for things, don't we? In fact, we raise our kids that way, don't we? Work hard and you will get ahead. When people like you, when you do things, you will find their favor. And don't we take that mentality or think we can take that mentality into faith? And it's what blinds us. The message of the gospel is a mystery. It doesn't make sense. We want to look at life and we want to say, God, I know I'm far from you, but you know what, God? I want to earn my way to get there to you. I want to do everything I can to get there. And that industriousness that we have is what prevents us from seeing a Jesus who went to the cross and he says, you don't have to work for anything because what you need, I've already done. And so what I offer you in faith and what I offer you in salvation is a gift freely given to you. You don't have to work for it. But we still fight that. In our blindness, we said, no. I still want to earn it. Let me find favor. Let me do good deeds and then you'll like me more. But can we just stop for a moment and see how baffling and just how crazy this is? Because I don't know about you, but if my works of my life were going to be placed on a scale, how do I know when that scale tips in my favor? That leads to a life of running on a treadmill that I can never get off, trying to appease a deity that I hope will find me favorable one day. How do you win in this system that says, I don't know if I've done enough to get by. I don't know if every good deed I've done says I'm acceptable. And yet, a majority of people still look and are blinded by this because they say, I just can't accept it. It has to be this way. I must work and earn it. In the previous letter Paul wrote to the Corinthian church, 1 Corinthians 1:18, he writes that this is exactly what it is and how it is. He says, the message of the cross appears to be foolishness to those who are perishing. But for us who are being saved, it's the power of God. He says, you're exactly right. When you consider the gift that Jesus Christ offers, it doesn't make any sense. Everything about you says, let me earn it, let me work for it. And Jesus says, you don't have to. In fact, Paul in another letter in Ephesians writes these words. He said, it is by grace that you have been saved through faith. It is not of yourselves. It is a gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. The message of the cross is a gift. It's Christmas. You did nothing to earn it. Freely given by a Savior who loves us. These are the things that I think that blind us. There's probably more. It's not an exhaustive list, but I certainly think those are four things that I see in my experiences with people. Are you here today, and as I've listed those four things, are any of those things maybe blinding you to the gospel? As we've said, this in the spiritual battle, the enemy wants desperately to keep those blinders on you, to keep the individuality, industriousness, inclusiveness, to say, no, you can't believe because of this. And Jesus says, yes, you can. And through his power, the blinders can come off. Are you blind this morning? I want to take a moment before we close to just talk to another segment of the crowd today. Those that aren't blind. Those that have seen the gospel and have accepted it. What I want to ask you this morning is just simply the way Paul talks about evangelism has nothing to do with us giving you pieces of paper to go hand to people and to hand to strangers. It has nothing about even memorizing certain passages of Scripture or being able to answer somebody's question or asking them a question that you have a good answer to. When Paul talks about evangelism here in 2 Corinthians, he does so in the context of this spiritual battle. And he says, this is war. This is war. This isn't playground time. This is a battle, and are you taking it seriously? And I'm just curious this morning, what does your behavior and your lifestyles toward others say about what team you are fighting for or helping? Because I'm convinced that if we don't take this seriously, we're exactly where Satan wants us to be. We would never intentionally say, I want to serve on Team Satan. But I do believe that for many, the church in America specifically is exactly where Satan wants us to be, because he says, you are in your nice little walls, you're content, you sing your nice little songs, you feel good about yourself when you leave, you got a great pastor who does a great job every Sunday. And then you go home and you get back to your life. Just stay there. Sit there. Do that. And I think he says, I don't have anything else to do because you're doing it for me. You guys know me. You know I don't bring the guilt ever in sermons. I don't like to be harsh. But as I studied this passage this week, I just couldn't get away from it. And the question that came up over and over and over in my mind is, whose team am I on? Whose team am I on? Who am I helping? Who am I serving by the way I live, by the way I approach evangelism? And before you think, well, Brent, you're a pastor, this is easy for you, it's not. I sit right where you do. It's not any easier for me. It terrifies me at times to think about sharing faith with somebody. What if I offend them? What if they ask me a question I don't have the answer to? What if what I say pushes them further away? I had that conversation a month or so ago. I was sitting with an individual who was talking. We were having this spiritual conversation, and I have no idea what I said, but there was I know what I said. I was talking about Jesus, and I said, I firmly believe that he's the only way we truly have peace in this life. And the guy stands up and he says, that's it, I'm out of here. That's what I don't like about churches. You guys are just so exclusive, and so I'm walking out of here. And I thought to myself, what have I done? What did I say? But we can't be motivated or consumed by the obstacles to sharing faith. We have to find something else that motivates us more. I think we have to move beyond the obstacle of fear that can prevent us from sharing. I think we have to move beyond the obstacle of ignorance and inexperience, of not knowing what to say or not knowing how to say it. Do you know how you overcome inexperience? It's genius. You do it. Isn't that radical? You know how you overcome ignorance? You read, you study, you pray, you talk to others. You see, we have to move beyond the fear, we have to move beyond the ignorance and the inexperience, and we have to get to a place where we are motivated by love. And I wonder if our lack of motivation by love actually shows a lack of love towards those who don't believe. When we look at Jesus and we see what motivated him, it is one word. It is love. One of my favorite passages is Matthew 9:36. It says this, it says, when Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. And his compassion for them moved him to action. To care for them, to heal them, to feed them, to die for them, to call them from their sin to abundant life. I just wonder, are we allowing the obstacles to keep us stagnant and on the sidelines? Or will we allow that love, the same love that Jesus had, to motivate us to get off the sidelines and start fighting for the world, for those who don't believe? So today I've kind of spoken two different sermons in one to two different groups of people. And as I wrap up, I just want to ask you this question. Where are you? Where are you? Are you blind? Again, I don't mean to be rude or disrespectful by saying that. We're all blind to something. But when it comes to the gospel of Jesus Christ, when it comes to the message that Jesus Christ came to this earth, God took on human flesh, lived on this earth, and died so that you could know him, so that you could be reconciled to God, so that you could live with him eternally. Are you blinded to that message? If so, has one of the things that I've mentioned today been an obstacle that you've seen, a cause for your blindness, and maybe today the cracks are beginning to form in that, and you look at that and you say, okay, maybe there's a reason for faith. Maybe the obstacles that I've had are not what they should have been. If that's happening today, I just tell you, that's God that's removing the blinders from your life. The spiritual battle is being waged right now, here in this moment, in this place. And God is calling you to be His child. What do you have to do? Absolutely nothing. Stop focusing on what you have to do and realize that everything has already been done by Jesus Christ, His death and resurrection. For the other half of the room, you see Jesus clearly? Are you allowing some of those obstacles of sharing faith to prevent you from taking that step out of that comfort zone to lean into with compassion those that don't yet believe? You know, sometimes we make it so much more difficult than it has to be. I was doing research this week for this sermon, and one of the things I stumbled across was the guy who said, "Don't make it that hard." Sometimes it can be as easy as mentioning to somebody, hey, you know, I went to church the other day and heard this. Or maybe it's looking for that opportunity when a friend or coworker says something that says, you know, hey, you know, I'm really struggling with my marriage, or man, this was really hard, or my kid did this and we really don't know what to do. And you look and you just say, hey, you know, I've been there. But you know what helped me was my faith. And don't say anything else. Just leave it there. And if they don't say anything, all right, walk away. But if they look at you and they say, really, how did faith help you with that? You know what you have? The blindness beginning to leave, the light beginning to shine in the darkness, and an opportunity to share Jesus with somebody. Don't make it harder than it has to be. What are you this morning? Where are you this morning? Blinded? But recognizing your need for Jesus, or not blind and realize there's more that we can do to advance the kingdom of God, to go to war, to battle for the souls of mankind.